Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. The Steelers, last night, one big parade today in Pittsburgh. The big play of the night, Mason Rudolph to Deontay Johnson for 43 yards of the score.
Bill Hillgrove, by the way, will have the call.
Hold on,
yeah. You heard last night on 100.9 The Valley.
Here we go. I'm ready now. We had a computer lockup. Hold on. Here we go.
Rudolph stays in the shotgun. The Oklahoma State kid. Connor stands to his right. He wants to throw it. He's back. Big rush. Throws it down the field. A man wide open. And it's pulled in by Deontay Johnson for the touchdown. Rudolph to Johnson. 43 yards. And the Steelers are having fun playing football.
It's fun when you win. They won 27-3 last night. Heard on 100.9 The Valley and the Steelers Radio Network. Bill Hillgrove with the call. And speaking of last night, yes, I believe they had a parade today. Boulevard of the Allies. A lot of fun. Neil Coulong was on hand. Hello, Neil.
It's crazy because the parade route itself was far from planned out before the game. But it's amazing how quickly things like that get organized when you beat Cincinnati 27-3 in a game that appeared far worse than 27-3. So it definitely brings a lot of excitement. It brings a lot of people back on the bandwagon, it seems.
Yeah, it's done that. Well, let's start with Mason Rudolph. What kind of job did he do, and how well, in your opinion, did he see the field, especially as the game went?
You know, one thing with Rudolph that to me has become evidently clear, and I'm really trying to talk myself out of this just for the sake of a future with him, but my, he looks like Alex Smith. I can't help but notice. This is not an issue of play calling. People seem to think it is. You know, the game plan can't be short passing and all this stuff. He's looking down the field and he's dumping it off. He does not take risks down the field, and that can be a good thing. But at the same time, a guy like Alex Smith, what was the stat on him when he was in Kansas City? Like, he never won a game with scoring fewer than 27 points or something like that. It just really indicates that game manager cliche. And I think that's really what we're seeing with Rudolph, and I'm not sure how much of that is him versus what the philosophy that they're feeding him is. He keeps saying he wants to go downfield. He's going to take looks for it, and he very well may be doing that. I'm not even sure that he's not doing it, because I saw plenty of receivers in that 15 to 18-yard box down the field. We just don't see him trying that very often, and that's probably how you put up a game like he had last night, which, you know, short of some, you know, I don't want to call it, you know, gimmicky or gadgetry types of plays, but a lot of different stuff that nobody has seen the Steelers run on film before. Without that, I'm not sure.
Ever.
I'm not sure how effective he really was in terms of the game plan. He really looked to be a guy that didn't lose the game and counted on his teammates to win it. And he certainly got that from a lot of players. I mean, the defense was on his head for the most part, which is helped by the fact that Cincinnati appears to put maybe three guys in pass protection. The other ones who are out there, I'm not sure what they're doing. But it's not hard to win a game when you're not making mistakes going against an offense as tragically inept as Cincinnati's is. So Rudolph did the things that he needed to do to help his team win. I'm just not sure I'm confident going up against a better offense if he's going to be able to throw punches with whoever that is.
They're going to get into a game. It's going to be a shootout at some point, and he's going to have to out-duel somebody. Last night was not it. Okay, last night was not it at all. I'll say this, on the one touchdown throw, I think it was to Johnson. That was a well-thrown ball, and that ball had something on it.
Yeah, it's not that he lacks the ability, for sure. And we've seen that. I think it's easy for us to rest on that because we can, you know, sight with amazing accuracy the two or three passes he's thrown deep so far. It's just that there hasn't been much of a sample of it. But I agree, it was a great ball. Obviously to the right guy. He found the right receiver. The rookie, you know, really did a good job overcoming a mistake early in the game, and he played well. He's capable of doing it. He just doesn't seem to want to do it. So success like last night, you want to be excited for him. You want to think, okay, good, things are rolling along, but you're not going to get the level of opponent that you just played. If not for the Miami Dolphins, we'd be talking about the Bengals, and that says a lot for that organization. We're talking about a Bengals team that's below even the precedent that they set for early in the season over the last 20, 30 years. They're just catastrophically bad. I mean, it was an absolute nightmare. I'd hate to be a Bengals fan today. But overall, he did the things he was supposed to do, but I'm not jumping all over that kind of tricky, sort of confusing 124 rating. I don't know if you ever noticed that. Those are the players that tend to kind of have the solid game, but they're not the guy that you're talking about overall in terms of ownership of the game. I didn't feel that from Rudolph yesterday. I thought he did good things, and I don't want to set the bar very high for him, but this is a tryout situation for him.
Sure.
I'd like to see him get a little bit more daring, because exactly as you said, he's going to go up against teams where he's going to have to win those games. He's going to have to beat those defenses on his own instead of waiting around for them to beat themselves.
There's a lot of talent among the elite quarterbacks, but they're also the ones that don't play as safe. The quarterbacks that are not in the same category, they try to play it safer because they don't have enough confidence to make the kind of plays we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, too. I also think that it's fitting if you take out the two deepest passes a quarterback threw in a game for completions. Where is he at? And you get a much better sense of what their real yards per attempt is. And Rudolph isn't very high. I mean, offensively, they didn't play a great game yesterday. I know it seems like it, but they had a couple big drives, which is good. But a lot of zero drives. The first half in particular was really sloppy in a lot of ways. They turned it on in the second half. But this is – you're playing against a beaten-down opponent who's in year zero of a rebuild with a brand-new head coach. I really hope that you can beat that team by 24 points on Monday night in your own stadium. You should be able to do that. So, you know, I'm holding. I didn't go to the victory parade myself, but I know that they're.
Come on, you have to find a way to have some fun in life.
I save that for after Ravens wins, pointless or otherwise. At the very least, we know that they're you know not going to go 0-16 on the year. I definitely think it's a good start, and we saw a lot more of what this team can and should be. But we're going to see as this year goes on. Really how bad the Bengals are. And I think some people, the pessimistic ones, are going to go back and say it should have been more than 27, and maybe it should have.
Right. Defensively, I know, look, the Bengals don't have much offensively, especially with Green not in the lineup. At least defensively, how well did the Steelers play?
I thought they did the things that they were supposed to do. I'll give defense a little bit more of a credit for reaching that level than I will on offense, because they're the ones that have to respond to everything. They don't dictate the tempo of the game. They attacked exactly where they were supposed to attack, but I was laughing in the second half. I mean, Andy Dalton looked legitimately mad, skulking off the field, getting hit again. I mean, they were all over him the entire game. I mean, there was not a thing he was going to be able to do. They attacked. You have to like that aggression. They had a lot on the line, I think, with this. They understand that the level of hype that surrounds the players who were on that field. I mean, people are really starting to clue into the fact that they've dedicated a huge portion of their draft in terms of value to the defensive side of the ball. And certainly they've taken their criticism. But when you take off the two high-level playmakers from the offense and you see a depleted offensive team that's down to bare bones, really, no premium picks outside of their line anywhere, and not really much of anything that takes over from the power that Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell brought. You're starting to see now, it's like, okay, well, the defense really should be outplaying the offense this year. If it didn't catch up before, it really has to now. I think they took that upon themselves in this game, and they played very well. Even Mark Barron got in on the action. I mean, it takes a lot for Mark Barron to be making plays from what we've seen the first three games. He got an interception. I thought that was great. Cam Hayward had, I think, two sacks, maybe two and a half or something. Watt was outstanding again. A guy makes a splash play, maybe two or three of them every game now, and has the last 12, 13 games he's played. He's a legitimate high-end player in the NFL. Stephon Tuitt's having a Pro Bowl year so
really
far.
Good.
Yeah, yeah, I mean,
really
it, good. It's their defensive line, their front seven has played exceptionally well, I think, by and large, over the last three games. They've had some problems, I think, come with a secondary that might not be as strong as we want it to be, safeties that have kind of been interchanged through four games. But the defensive line has played very well. We've got to give them that. I mean, you know, Bud even got in with the sack with probably the best move he's ever made on a line on a pass rush.
You know, the last time I saw somebody swing and miss that badly was John Lester for the Cubs going up to the plate, pitcher trying to hit. I haven't seen anybody swing that bad. He totally missed him on the play.
It was great to see just the fact that he's able to put everything together in that short of a space, and it really kind of shows the level of artistry, that the athletic artistry that comes into rushing the passer. I mean, he did three or four concerted things that were both offensive and defensive. You know, he countered to the move that was put on him, and he found a way around it. And he did all of that in one swift motion.
He set him up.
Really, I mean, it's really the Bud Dupree you hope to see, considering how amazing of an athlete he is. You hoped he'd get to the point where he could put all of that together. I think, at least on you know, his one shining moment, which might be the only one of his career, he did put all of that together, and he looked like a high-end pass rusher. And you put that along with the power that he's able to bring in rushing the passer, which really hasn't been much of a problem for this team over the last 3 years. But they dominated that game, absolutely destroyed whatever semblance of an offensive line the Bengals have. I think Andy Dalton's going to put himself on IR here pretty soon. I mean, you wouldn't blame him. I mean, he had absolutely no protection at all. And the Steelers exploited it. You should get 8 sacks against that kind of a unit. And they did. They dominated the game from start to finish.
Now, obviously, we'll have to see how it plays out. But what if the Steelers were to beat Baltimore? Because that's next, and that's at home. What do you think that then does to the dynamic if suddenly they take last night and then they follow it up and actually play well and win?
For me, it would be not to be that guy, but it would be exactly what I said it was going to be in this division. It's going to be a three-team race.
Yeah.
All three of those teams have flaws, potentially fatal flaws. One of them is going to go to the playoff. I'm going to rule the Bengals out of the postseason this year. But between Baltimore and Cleveland...
Look, you make bold statements like that, and I'm telling you, it's going to get questioned by the fan base.
I'm a hot taker. I'm a hot taker. I'll admit that right up front. Between Baltimore, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh, they have pretty noticeable glaring flaws. And I think all three of them are teams that are going to be at a much better level this time next year. I think next year that's going to be the division to beat. They're going to have to grow into that. They're going to have to take some tough losses the way all three of them have this season. It's going to be a battle between them to see what they can do. And I understand. I saw Lamar Jackson go crazy against Miami. It was great. It's fun to watch, you know, the older brother beating up the younger brother. Everyone enjoys that. But Baltimore is not nearly that good of a football team. They're a decent team. They're not a great team. I don't see why Pittsburgh couldn't beat them. Defensively, I think Pittsburgh has a lot more than Baltimore probably is going to be able to handle unless they can get their ground game going. But Baltimore's defense is not good. You can't lose. I mean, it's no different than Pittsburgh's offense. You can't lose that many starters in one offseason and just add Earl Thomas and act like they're going to be, you know, the level that you've been at. They're going to have to take a step back in order to take two steps forward. I think Kansas City saw that. I certainly think that Cleveland saw that. And they put 73 points on them in two games. That doesn't happen to Baltimore very often. The difference is you're, you know, not playing against a team that through 4 weeks hasn't won a game yet. You know, you play against legitimate NFL competition, it's going to be a little bit tougher. You're going to be, you know, more of who you really are. Pittsburgh, on the other hand, in many ways should have beaten Seattle, had plenty of opportunities to beat San Francisco. They beat themselves more than anything in that game. But those are two good NFL teams. I'm not saying that Pittsburgh is necessarily better. I just don't think that 1-3 is the end of the season for them. I definitely think they can beat Baltimore. I think it's going to be a battle. I think it's going to be a tough game. Really, it's going to come down to whether or not Pittsburgh can stop their running game, and I'm not totally sure that they can. But it's going to be a battle. They're not all that different of teams. Pittsburgh wins that game, but they're what, a game out or tied or something. I mean, they're tied with Baltimore, and it would depend there on what Cleveland does. But right. You could see a three-way tie at 2-3, and it wouldn't surprise me if at the end of the season there's a three-way tie at 8-7 going into week 17. So all of them are going to build. They're going to have their ups and downs. But I wouldn't put Pittsburgh that far out of contention with either of those teams. I think you're crazy if you don't think that Pittsburgh could beat either one of them in a tight competitive game.
We have a series of noisemakers and pennants that we're going to be sending to you that we picked up from the parade today. So we want to make sure it's our personal gift to you.
Good. I'll save them for next week, because then people are really going to get excited. You beat Baltimore regardless of how good Baltimore is. That's the place you got to be. And they got Cleveland after that, too. Imagine that, yeah. Ron. Go up 3-0 in the division right off the bat and lose to everybody else. That might win you the division this year. I don't know.
That could be it. Neil coming up with the controversial formulas. Appreciate it very much, Neil.
Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you.
Neil Coulon, USA Today, back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors. Just handed a note before I came back on. The Jets are bad. Huh. I'm not going to say who that came from.
Hey, man. 13.5 point spread. I'm betting the Jets this weekend. So there you go. I guarantee it's way closer than you think it is. And I will come on this show the next day and take my beating if I need to.
It doesn't matter.
Okay. It matters for some of us.
I know it does. And I just... Look, people can do whatever they want with their money. It's your money.
I just mean in general, as a fan,
But I love watching the game for who's going to win or lose.
Oh, yeah, me too. I want the Jets to win. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is I really don't think... I don't feel like a lamb being led to the slaughter this week. I feel like that the Eagles are in a classic trap situation, and the Jets have players coming back this week. So I think that it's going to be closer than you think it's going to be. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Jets wind up pulling off something shocking. I really wouldn't be. And I don't have that kind of faith in
you
this
mean
team
scoring?
Ever. Ha ha. I don't have that kind of faith in this team ever. Ever.
You know I really don't care, do
you? I know you don't care. It's all for radio. I get it.
I really don't care.
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't live and die with these teams like I used to. I kind of lived and died with the Mets a little bit this year. When I see some indication
that... Because you asked about the MVP, I told you, I think it was off the air, I told you.
Yeah.
And so everyone understands. I don't really care who wins the MVP. I stopped caring about that years ago. It's just whatever. But there is a bailout in this particular vote. I think if you hand me a ballot, I would vote Cody Bellinger, the National League Most Valuable Player. I think for the longest period of time, he was playing a complete game, offensively, defensively, with power, that allowed the Dodgers to build a huge lead. So when the season was really on for the Dodgers, Cody Bellinger was on. As for Pete Alonso, the bailout is this. You can vote for him to be Rookie of the Year. So, in other words, they both end up getting honored in the season. You don't have to make a choice.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And there's no doubt about that. And I feel the same way. Plus, Bellinger is hitting 45 points. You know, his average is 45 points higher. His OPS is higher. Like, there's a lot of things. But Alonso also has the most, like, clutch RBI in the majors. I mean, you can go either way. But I hear what you're saying. Yeah, there is a bail.
I mean, clutch RBIs, I mean, okay, the Mets didn't make the playoffs, so obviously whatever it wasn't clutch enough.
Well, no, that's unfair.
Bellinger drove in runs that made a difference in winning games.
That's not necessarily true either. I mean, like, you know,
Okay, well, hold on. One of the keys to winning is that you've got to be able to do things that put your team in front to stay. That is the, you know, and Alonso's a fabulous young player. But guess what? The Mets didn't win. Whatever he did wasn't good enough. That's
no,
why
it
when
had
I
nothing to do with
that's,
him. Come
that's,
on. That's you know
please,
that's not
I,
true.
Like, oh no, please. I actually want to get serious now.
you're wrong on this one.
Okay.
Because guess what? This is why I'll give you a really good example. The war people, when they say, hey, look at his war number. I don't care about a guy's war number. I don't care. Because guess what? The year that Mike Trout was touted as being the MVP because of his war number went up against Miguel Cabrera, who won the Triple Crown.
Right.
Miguel Cabrera, his Triple Crown, because of his hits, put Detroit into the playoffs. Mike Trout, who was marvelous that season, without him, they would have finished, instead of 10 games under 500, they would have finished 25 under. That doesn't matter. That's irrelevant. It's a great individual season, but the other guy's hits put a team over the top and made a difference. That's why I look at an MVP. Who put somebody over the top that made a difference to get them to the promised land?
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, so we were talking about the relevance of the MVP. You're still into that stuff as somebody who's grown out of it, and I grew out of it years ago. I don't care about individual awards anymore. It's like who wins it in a given year.
Right.
I realize these guys care about it deeply because they have in their contract clauses that if they win the award, they get a huge bonus. I got that.
That makes sense.
I mean, I got that. I mean, that was the whole thing with Antonio Brown not being the MVP of the Steelers last year. He was furious because he lost out on a huge bonus in his contract. That's what then, he decided to sit the last week of the season. All right, now he's unemployed. Now nobody can find Roquan Smith. I mean, there's a lot of things going on right now that are really strange.
But, I mean, my point as a fan and in defense of a Mike Trout or an A-Rod from
Mike
back
Trout,
when...
Mike Trout does not need any defense. He is the finest all-around player of this particular era that I've seen, and I think it's incredible what he has done. But when you get into individual races, I start looking at, okay, who made the difference in allowing something great to happen? I think in order to overcome that when you're with a mediocre team, you have to have an Andre Dawson kind of year where you hit 48 home runs and nobody else hits more than 30, and you sit back and go, okay, I know they're in last place, but good Lord, he was good. Right? And Trout's capable of that. But when you get into a race where you've got his war number is incredible. And like, okay, wins above replacement. So if I replace him, instead of being 10 games under 500, I'm 25 under 500. Well, okay. Meanwhile, this guy won the Triple Crown, and they won their division by a game. And if he doesn't get the hits that he got, they don't make the playoffs. All right, now, okay, that actually becomes a really easy vote for me. It's not even a debatable vote.
Well, yeah, but the point that I'm making is that, like, if I look at it this year, for example, like, you have, so the MVP can only come from the Astros, the Yankees, or any of the wild, the A's, or from the D-Rays. They're just the Rays now. Like, they're the only teams that they can come from. Like, it can't be Mike Trout, or it can't be Rafael Devers, who had a tremendous season. Any of these guys who have these numbers that trumped everything, and the Red Sox, who fell way short because their bullpen was horrifyingly bad. Or like the Mets, for example, Pete Alonso would be automatically discounted from the MVP despite the fact that his clutch hits, which you're talking about, he has the most of them in the majors according to statistical fact, but they also have the most blown saves in the majors according to statistical fact. So why does Alonso lose out on an MVP? And I know you don't care about individual
achievement, because when things were on the line, Bellinger played terrific.
And so did Alonso. He has the most hits in those situations.
Excuse me. In the month after the All-Star break, Pete Alonso went into a terrible slump, and it put the Mets out of the race. So it's,
Okay, first off, your information is way off. They were 11 games
me.
Under before the All-Star
excuse
break.
Excuse me. Did Pete Alonso go into a slump after the All-Star break and hit what it take him about 3-4 weeks at a home run after the home run hitting contest?
It took him 2 or 3 weeks to kind of snap out of it, but he finished the year with 53 home runs and 120 RBIs.
And it got them where?
And he has four. That's not his fault. The bullpen blew literally five separate times runs or better leads.
This is what I always enjoy about this. I always enjoy talking to people where I have no dog in the hunt.
Right.
And somebody's so emotional because it's their team.
No, I would defend any team like this, because I would defend the Red Sox like this too. Rafael Devers, I don't know what his clutch statistics are, but I know that his bullpen was horrifying.
But I watch games, okay?
So do I.
You can see who makes the difference. You got to be able to watch and have a feel. I don't need a number. Okay, Rafael Devers had a terrific year, so he should be recognized with a Silver Slugger Award. That's fine. But now let's look around the league. Okay, what made the difference in getting the Astros 100-plus wins? What made the difference in the Yankees getting 100-plus wins? What made the difference in the Twins getting to 100-plus wins? They won 101 games this year.
I mean, I believe...
How the heck did they do that?
Right, I trust what you're saying, and no one can name who the best hitter on the Twins is. That's what's hilarious about that. But DJ LeMahieu for the Yankees definitely deserves an MVP, and I watch almost all their games.
He made a huge difference. The second they acquired them, they acquired somebody who's just a big-time player. And on a team that was so decimated by injuries, he was the offensive rudder all season long.
Or Gio or Charlo would be the other one.
I would have no problem voting for DJ LeMahieu.
Me too.
None.
I agree.
Zero. I'd have no problem, you know, voting in the National League for Cody Bellinger, because when the money was on the table, he was terrific. You take him out. Are the Dodgers as terrific in that run? Probably not. And so that's where I'm looking. Who is the swing factor that makes a difference in putting a team, instead of sitting in the living room at the Chris Elio watch party, to actually playing in the game? Hey, if I'm going to look at, okay, who am I going to look at to be a Cy Young Award winner? Well, Gerrit Cole won 20 games for a team that won 100-plus. I mean, I'm looking like, okay, fine. I mean, Eduardo Rodriguez won 19 games, but he won 19 games for a team that didn't make the playoffs. He had a terrific year. He should be recognized for it. But the other guy's 20 wins. And remember, you're playing in big games coming down the stretch where you're trying to make plays. Right? And now it's where it really counts. Now you're going to go up against the better lineups game in and game out. So that's where I start looking. Who are the swing guys that put this team in a position, unless it's such a monster season by somebody? Right? And in a year where the baseball is obviously juiced, I'm not going to get too wowed by 53 home runs. It's not 53 home runs in 1970. It's not George Foster hitting 52 home runs in 1977. Yeah, the ball was clearly juiced. That's why we had a record number of home runs this year. So now I'm going to look at who are the swing factors, who made plays in the field, who got hits when you needed it, who put your team over the top, who got them into the playoffs. If you take them out of the lineup, are they in the playoffs?
Right, but it's more than one factor, and that's like baseball is not. Like, you can't, it's not the NBA. Like, the NBA is so easy to pick an MVP in the NBA because one player can wreck an entire game in the NBA. In any other sport, maybe hockey is the only other sport that I could think of where maybe, like, if you get a goaltender who's all world, or you get a Sidney Crosby who's just unstoppable. Other than that, baseball, football, it's a little bit more involved, and you're right. You need to pick the swing guy. But I think discounting a player like Mike Trout, who didn't make the playoffs and
Okay, don't say that because you're wrong. I said Mike Trout is the best player of this era.
Right, but what I'm saying is taking him out of the conversation now, like an MVP for that reason.
But what's the? I did not take him out of the consideration for it. I said, but here's my logic. He is being in the world of sabermetrics in that particular year. What year was it that Cabrera won the Triple Crown? Was it 15? Something like that. Right. Okay. Sabermetrics. Look at his numbers. Okay, so it's wins above replacement. Okay, so if I take him out, the Angels, instead of being 10 under 500, it would be 2,500. Okay, if I take Miguel Cabrera out of the Tigers lineup, let's do the same thing. They don't make the playoffs.
Right, but how many games do they lose? See, that's the difference. It's a complete.
No.
That's why WAR is important.
No, WAR is irrelevant. It's one of the single most irrelevant stats I've ever seen in my lifetime. I've never seen a stat more irrelevant and more of a guess, because that's all that stat is a guess. It's a complete guess.
If you're taking
wins above replacement, let's go back to 1960, okay? Ted Williams is the left fielder for the Boston Red Sox. Okay? He retires. So it should be obvious that no matter what, they cannot possibly put a player out there the next year that is going to be comparable to Ted Williams. And who do the Red Sox put out there? Some guy named Carl Yastrzemski.
Right, right.
So you don't know that if Mike Trout gets replaced, that the person comes in there and doesn't go out and just have an incredible... You don't know that.
Well, obviously, it's theoretical, it's a rookie.
That's why it is a complete guess.
I mean, nobody knew right? Pete Alonso was going to show up and hit 53 home runs this year.
That's why WAR is a complete guess.
It's not a complete guess. It's like a 80% guess, like a less than that, like a 20% guess, right? Because the reason I say that is compared to the rest of the league.
What sabermetricians take out of sports these days, and by the way, I think what they do is very valuable. I will take a look at metrics because I want to make sure I'm not missing anything. I always want to make sure I'm not missing anything as a play-by-play broadcaster. So what are the metrics in basketball? What are the metrics in football? And I do baseball as well. What are the metrics? I'll look at them. I want to make sure I'm not missing anything. But when it comes down to it, I've been broadcasting games for 40 years of my lifetime. I know what I'm looking at. I don't need numbers to tell me what I see.
I mean, it's hard to argue that. I mean, I'm not gonna throw down a gauntlet and be like, well, whatever. Like, I respect your years of knowledge. However, I'm gonna take your example of what you said, and you take a 41-year-old Ted Williams, who was still pretty amazing. Like, he hit .316.
Right.
I'm just saying my
point about Williams and Yaz is that it's obvious it should be somebody less. And it should be obvious, like, because nobody knew. He was playing for the Minneapolis Millers, for goodness sakes, Yastrzemski in 1960. And it turned out that, well, actually, it wasn't that bad of a, it wasn't quite the drop everyone thought.
I mean, it was a drop, but it wasn't, right, it wasn't off the cliff drop.
Right.
And eventually, it was a viable replacement, absolutely. But the point remains, I think it might be a generational thing, maybe. I hate to say that. Not like, you know, I'm not like a young chap, like a 20-year-old who's just opening my eyes to this. But it's like, I think there is value to like a WAR, you know, statistic, or at least saying, you know, it's not Mike Trout's fault that the Angels didn't make the playoffs, and his hits definitely contributed to their record, and they would have been way more atrocious if they weren't, and it's not his fault.
Exactly, but that's why I want to see who's the swing person in the race where their team accomplished something.
But he is the swing person in his race, in his team.
In the race to what?
In the race to just being better.
In the race to what? It's not a race to anything.
It's almost like saying he's irrelevant where he is.
Is he irrelevant where he is? Again, he is the best player of this generation, in my opinion.
Right?
Just my opinion. He's the best player of this generation. So there's no way on the planet I am putting down a single thing that he's doing. Well, when I'm talking about the MVP, right? I think that he's in a bad spot where he's not. His hits are big hits in the moment that they need it, but in the big picture, it's not doing anything. It's not making a dent in the big picture. And that's the problem. He doesn't make a dent in the big picture. As hard as he plays, as well as he plays, the example he sets out on the field, the great catches, stealing bases, it still doesn't make a dent.
All right, so let me... Right?
Because he doesn't have enough people around him. That's his organization's fault. But when I'm sitting there looking at an MVP, hey, I gotta take a look at, okay, who made the dent here? Right? Who made the difference in Devers had a great year. Bogaerts had a great year. But guess what? The Red Sox won 84 games. So, I mean, yeah, it was great, but it didn't, you know, it wasn't enough to overcome their problems.
So, I mean.
So I got to go someplace else. I got to look around and say, okay, where do I think? Let's see, LeMahieu. Boy, the Yankees, well, what a year. With all the injuries, he was the rudder the whole time. I got to look at him. Gerrit Cole won 20 games on a team that won over 100.
Well, Justin Verlander won like 18 on a team that won 100.
Right,
like,
right. And Verlander was terrific. Now I go to the National League. Bellinger, when the money was on the table and like everybody was really there, he was really there. He played terrific. Right when they needed him. Same thing when it comes to the pitching part.
But I mean, they had a stacked lineup. Also, like, this is what I'm saying. Like, you take a player you take a player like Alonso again, back to my team, right? And you take a team that was 11 games under 500 before the All-Star break, and all of a sudden they come out of the All-Star break and they win 23 out of 24 or something like that. Like 17 out of 23 or something ridiculous like that. And he was one of the catalysts of that. And then he winds up continuing to the very end of the season, breaks the rookie record, hits 53, to the very end. And they wind up turning around, which was a majorly bleak season, despite the fact that they had the worst bullpen in baseball next to maybe the Red Sox, is the only other team I could think of. And you're going to tell me that he doesn't deserve like major consideration for that compared to a Cody Bellinger, who in his own right did go into a slump. He was passed by Pete Alonso in both categories, RBI and home run. And granted, yes, he's on the first place team, but they have a better pitching staff. They have way better bullpen, like one of the best in baseball. They have
the Dodgers bullpen's not very good. Right? R.J. Anderson and I just talked about that in the show.
Oh
yesterday.
Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry, I'm thinking of the wrong team. Right? Yes.
And not only that, defensively, the Dodgers aren't very good. They have terrific starting pitching, and they have a terrific lineup.
Yes, you're right.
And he was when, because remember, they built a huge pad, so him going into a slump was irrelevant.
And now again, I'm gonna say I would vote for Cody Bellinger anyway. Like looking at the statistics that are important
to me.
And I said
Alonso had a great year and should be rookie of the year.
Well, yeah, and I think that's a runaway.
Okay. Right there. Okay. I mean, I think that's an easy vote to vote for him. He was great, but at 3 weeks after the All-Star break, when they really say, I'm not big on the home run contest at all. I would never let my guy in the home run contest.
Well, they were winning 3 weeks after that. Like, they won almost every game outside of the All-Star
break.
Yeah,
but he didn't play well. He had, what was he hitting, like 190-something during that stretch?
Yeah, he had a little tough spot.
He slumped. But I would never let my guys, I would never let them be in the home run contest. Never. I would not want my pitcher to pitch in the All-Star game, and I would not want my guy in the home run contest. Home run contest ruined swings.
I feel like it ruined David Wright's career, personally. He won the home run contest too, and his back that was it. I think that was it for him. His
then
career
your
took.
Guy, then your guy Cespedes.
Oh, he's a disaster. I think he's a money grubber personally. He'll come out. Watch, he'll come out. No, I'm telling you, he'll come out this year. All of a sudden, he's going to be healthy. I guarantee he'll be healthy this next season.
Right.
He's going to be healthy. Right. He's going to hit well. I mean, he's going to be great this year. The Mets are going to be better next year because he's going to be great. Right. In a lineup with Alonso and Conforto and whatever, he's looking for a contract.
Mikey Conforto.
Yeah, he had a good year. He had 33
home
runs this year.
Last time I talked to Mikey, he was 11 years old. So.
Yeah. He had the most empty 95 RBI season I've ever seen in my life. But that, you want to talk about lack of clutch, that's the guy you talk about. But I'll digress.
let's see. Again, I always look at analytics. I always do. I look at it in football because, again, I want to make sure I'm not missing anything. I think it's part of your preparation, and if you don't look at analytics in your preparation to do today's broadcast, then you are not doing the audience a service.
Right.
So I do look at it. Do I miss something in basketball? Points per possession? What am I looking here at? Defensive points per possession, things like that. What am I looking at in football? Okay, what's the grade out here in Pro Football Focus of the left tackle? What's the grade out of the center? Okay, what is his passing percentage when he is pressured versus not pressured? These are all things I look at.
Of course.
Baseball, I'm looking at it all the time. But when it comes down to it, when I start the broadcast, while it's very useful pregame information, it is really useless in-game situation.
Of course.
Right? And so I don't need to have a metric tell me what I'm seeing. Because I've seen almost all of it.
Well, it's part of the reason why it drives me crazy when a manager will take out, a pitcher who's gone through seven, struck out the side in the seventh inning, but analytics tells him that, oh, you need to bring your reliever in now because he's got 105 pitches, but he just gassed everyone in the seventh inning, put him back out there. That's what baseball is.
See, what's happened is the better managers are the ones that have a feel for the game. Right? A feel for the game is somewhat innate. But you can tell who has a feel for it, and those who don't have confidence are the ones that rely on the numbers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay, it says I got to do it here. The card says I do this now. Sometimes it's okay to look at the card and go, you know what? Give me three more batters, okay? We're going to, I'm going to use an opener. This is really cool. No, it's not. Now, how about your starter go six innings, and then now you do mix and match in the last three with your bullpen?
It goes as far as he can go until he starts to falter a little bit and then bail, you know, like get a feel for it. I agree with you there. Well, that I agree with 100%.
I mean, you have too many, there are too many coaches and too many managers now that are trying to do things robotically off a card. And you can't, that's not how it's supposed to be. And you got to have some feel for it. You got to have a little bit of, intuition about what's going on out there. It's just like when we're sitting there doing a game, we can feel right away when something's turned, right away. Right? And Jack and I felt right away the Tariq Castro Fields play at the goal line. We looked at each other, went to a break. We said, game's over. They'll go the other way. And did. You just know.
Yep.
But you just know.
Right.
And that's, if that's because you've done it long enough, doesn't mean you're right about everything, but you're right about most of it. And I don't need a number to tell me.
Right.
Like, I'll look at it later and go, yeah, that confirms what we saw.
That's the usual of the way.
All right, that confirms what we saw. And like the deal with Trout, best player of this generation. But every year is a year unto itself where you've got to look at, okay, what swung it? And my argument against is not how awesome the player is. Right? But in the end, if you take this guy out of the lineup, they don't make the playoffs. Because obviously they have a better lineup. But if you take that guy out of the lineup, that'll make the playoffs. You take him out of the lineup, they're just worse than they were before.
Right. I mean, I disagree with you on that, but I see your point. So,
because, again, you're comparing him to a guy who had a triple crown year, which means his numbers were awesome.
Right. No, and again, I would have voted for the triple crown guy.
Right. I know you would. I'm just saying, you're not comparing him to somebody who had pedestrian numbers.
Right.
You are comparing him to somebody else who had awesome numbers, and it turned out his numbers were important enough to get him into the playoffs.
Yep.
So that to me becomes a determining factor. All right, we'll wrap it up here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.